Hello, this is Ukraine Calling, a weekly roundup of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on a main issue. I'm Marta Dechok for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here are the headlines that caught my attention this week.
Hardliners, conservative hardliners, seized power from President Mikhail Gorbachev.
The announcement from Moscow at 4:30 this morning carried a shocking impact across the world. Many Western leaders have been on holiday. They're urgently discussing how to respond.
В связи с невозможностью по состоянию здоровья исполнения Горбачевым Михаилом Сергеевичем своих обязанностей президента СССР.
The roots of the current crisis should be sought in 1991.
Вчора ситуація в районі проведення антитерористичної операції вчергове загострилася.
It's been a mixed week of news. This episode of Ukraine Calling airs on the day that marked the 25th anniversary of the 1991 Moscow coup. That led to the collapse of the USSR and changed the course of history. Later in the show, we'll bring you an interview with Oleksandr Tkachenko, who covered the story back then as a journalist. And Harvard historian Sihi Plochy, who explains how the roots of the current crisis in Ukraine can be traced back to 1991. But back to the present. One of the main stories that dominated the news in Ukraine and other countries was also about roots of crisis. Ukraine hit the international headlines when various media outlets began reporting on the relationship between Paul Manafort and Viktor Yanukovych. Manafort is Donald Trump's campaign manager, and also has a history of working as an international PR consultant. It seems that one of his former clients was Viktor Yanukovych, Ukraine's now fugitive former president. Ukraine's newly formed anti-corruption bureau reported that it had uncovered Manafort's name in a series of documents they're going through. The documents are handwritten ledgers of secret payments made by Yanukovych and the Party of Regions. In those ledgers, Manafort's name appears between the years 2007 and 2012, as having received a total of $12.7 million in payments. These payments were reportedly part of an illegal, off-the-book system that included Ukrainian politicians, offshore shell companies, Washington lobbyists, a Russian oligarch close to President Putin, and perhaps more. Manafort denied that he had ever worked for the Ukrainian or Russian governments, but the New York Times ran a photograph of the building that housed Manafort's office in downtown Kyiv. On Thursday, Ukraine's Anti-Corruption Bureau began posting scanned images of the documents on their webpage. We'll post a link to them on our website and you can see them too. According to a Bloomberg report, Ukraine's economy is expanding. Although the report described the overall recovery as lackluster, the latest figures are better than they've been since 2013. Between April and June, GDP rose by 1.3% as compared with the previous year. There are still problems, such as what they call the lack of urgency in tackling corruption, which is contributing to the holdup of the IMF loan. Another upbeat report appeared in the Ukrainian Business Journal. They interviewed outgoing U.S. Ambassador Jeffrey Pyatt, who said that the next chapter for Ukraine will be economic. He highlighted IT, energy, and commodities as areas of strength. For those of you who may not know, IT is the third largest component of Ukraine's GDP, and Ukraine is one of the biggest IT countries in Europe. On Monday, a new e-filing system was introduced for state employees to report their incomes in Ukraine. Listeners may remember Ukraine Calling reported on preparations for this in earlier episodes. The move is a requirement from Ukraine's international partners as a measure for battling corruption. However, there is a lot of domestic criticism about the way in which this was introduced. The data protection system was not certified in advance. Civil society groups and some politicians were very vocal in saying that this will allow officials to submit fictitious income statements that can't be verified later. In response to the criticism, the chief of the State Fiscal Service of Ukraine, Roman Nasirov, who's overseeing the process, said that the system would be improved within 2 months, and after that he would submit his resignation. War continues in the east. Every day the media reports about continuous attacks and shelling against Ukraine. This week there were also reports about fears of impending provocations, that more heavy weapons banned by the Minsk agreements were moved from Russia onto parts of the Donbas that Ukrainian government does not control. And over the past 7 days, 6 Ukrainian soldiers were killed and 36 were wounded. Hromadske Radio reported this week that the history curriculum for Ukrainian children is once again being updated. During the Yanukovych government, Education Minister Dmytro Tabachnik had ordered textbooks to be rewritten in a way that Ukrainian history was presented as integrated with Russian history. This is now being reversed by a working group that aims to have the new curriculum ready for September. Ukraine will be taught as a separate entity again, with Crimea as part of the historical narrative. In the Rio Olympics, Ukraine was in 23rd place after 13 days of competition. It had won 8 medals in total, 2 gold, 4 silver, and 2 bronze. Oleg Vernyayev won Ukraine's first gold on Tuesday in men's parallel bars and gymnastics. Yuriy Chiban won the second gold in men's canoe sprint on Thursday. With that win, Chiban holds on to the title of Olympic champion for 4 more years. He had taken the gold for Ukraine in London in 2012. However, some commentators in Ukraine are noting that Ukraine's overall performance in international sport is slipping. A few weeks ago, Ukraine Calling reported on the car bomb killing of journalist Pavel Sheremet in downtown Kyiv. After that, a number of articles appeared in Western media outlets that raised concerns about the deterioration of free speech in Ukraine. This week, one of Ukraine's top media analysts, Natalia Lihachova, gave her assessment. She argues that context is needed to understand the full picture, that there are issues of corporate pressures, self-censorship, and low levels of societal trust towards media, but overall, Ukraine's media landscape is diverse, and there's a lot of different opinions and information presented in various media outlets. We'll post a link to all the articles on our website. Read them and decide for yourself. 25 years ago, on the 19th of August, 1991, the world woke up to the news of the Moscow coup. A group of hardliners had seized power in the Kremlin, declared a state of emergency, and an end to the reforms of Mikhail Gorbachev. Ukraine was still part of the USSR then, working on reforms of its own, including moving towards independence. Since this week's episode of Ukraine Calling airs exactly the same day, we've decided to take a look back at those events from two different perspectives. Oleksandr Tkachenko is today the CEO of one of Ukraine's largest media corporations, Studio One Plus One. Back in 1991, he was a young journalist and he was working for Ukrainian state television because all television was back then state-owned. And he was one of the first Ukrainians to report for a Western media outlet. He was working for Reuters. Mr. Tkachenko, thank you very much for joining us.
I appreciate this. Thank you.
Could you please tell our listeners, let's go back to 1991. What was it like reporting on the coup, a crackdown from within the Soviet Union, working for a Western media outlet? What was it like?
It was one of the rarest opportunities to report something, because on state television during these 3-4 days of the coup, there was no opportunity to report what was really going on in Ukraine. So for me, it was an opportunity to remain as a journalist. And in fact, Reuters became the first news outlet who reported about voting in Verkhovna Rada those days. And I'm proud that I was the person who did it.
So you broke the story?
Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Now, at which point, because you mentioned you reported when Ukraine already voted for independence when the coup failed, at which point did you feel that the coup was going to fail? It was very tense for a few days. There were tanks on the streets of Moscow.
I was staying one day in the yard of Verkhovna Rada, Ukrainian parliament, and suddenly saw two helicopters flying above. And they simply flew away and did nothing. So I realized that if with all opportunities, nothing happened from military side, it's gone. So there were no real tension apart of fears and nervous of democratic-oriented population, what will happen. But when I saw that they did nothing, I realized that finally it will be peaceful and of this coup.
That's quite a different scenario from what we saw in Ukraine in 2014. Can we look at any parallels? Is there anything that we can learn from the events of 1991 that are relevant for Ukraine today, when it's had part of its territory annexed and it's on the receiving end of the war?
It's completely two different situations, because in 1991, Ukraine first of all, voted in parliament, and second, after that, in December, voted on referendum for independence. It was peaceful breakdown, legal decision of majority of Ukrainian people to become independent. Now we have military intervention of Russia, annexation of Crimea, and its fight for independence in physical way, because in 1991 it was occasion that came because of the coup in Moscow. Now it's real fight for free, European-oriented Ukraine.
One more question, if I may. You broke the story of Ukraine declaring independence for Reuters, and you mentioned earlier that you could not report on what was happening in Ukraine on Ukrainian media. What's the role of journalism and journalists in the current crisis in Ukraine?
In current crisis?
Yes.
Ukrainian media became really independent and free. There is no doubt to say that we have free media in Ukraine now, and too much depends from Ukrainian journalists, because during the Revolution of Dignity, because of many media who reported about what's going on, we have successful, peaceful resolution of the crisis. I mean, not peaceful because of the death of the people, but I mean legally a resolution of the crisis. And now, during the period of war, the support of media of what's going on in Ukraine about reforms, about struggling in war with Russia, help Ukrainian people to realize how we can continue to fight for a revolution of dignity, how we can continue to fight with corruption, and at least have an optimism of what we will be facing in the future.
Mr. Tkachenko, thank you very much for joining us and sharing your unique insight. And once again, congratulations on that scoop back in 1991.
Thank you.
Serhii Plokhii holds the Harvard University Chair of Ukrainian Studies, named after Ukraine's eminent historian Mikhail Hrushevsky. He wrote an award-winning book called The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union. And in that book, Professor Plokhii reframed the way that we see the collapse of the Soviet Union back in 1991. Professor Plokhii, thank you very much for joining us. Can you briefly tell our listeners what your book, The Last Empire, reveals about how the USSR collapsed that we didn't previously know?
Well, first of all, thanks. Thanks for your invitation. It's a pleasure to talk to you again and have an opportunity to talk to a wider audience. My book really argues against a number of dominant narratives here in the United States and North America and also in Eastern Europe. According to the American narrative, it's President Reagan or maybe President Bush who really ended the Cold War by causing the collapse and disintegration of the Soviet Union. So the story starts with President Reagan going to Berlin, standing in front of the Berlin Wall and saying, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall," and then the rest followed. So I looked at the all available documents on the collapse of the Soviet Union, in particular the documents that are now available in the Bush Library, and got a very different story and a very different narrative of what was happening in those last few months of 1991. According to those documents, the American administration, the administration of President Bush, was doing everything in their power to prolong the life of the Soviet Union. And it was only in late November when the news reached Washington that there will be an overwhelming vote for Ukrainian independence that the decision was made to change the policy and abandon to a degree, stop the support, cut the lifeline for the President Gorbachev and his union project in Moscow.
We are now approaching the 25th anniversary of the failed coup in Moscow of August 19, 1991. In the wake of that, Ukraine declared independence, and then the events that you've just described followed. How important was Ukraine in the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Ukraine was extremely important. The fact that is widely known in Ukraine itself, but really largely forgotten in Moscow, in Washington, and all over the world. So it was a few days after the Ukrainian referendum, where more than 90% of voters supported the declaration of independence. So a few days after that, the leaders of the three Slavic republics gathered in Viskuli in Belarus and decided to dissolve the Soviet Union. And a few weeks after that, Gorbachev resigned and President Bush declared American victory in the Cold War. So all of that as a direct result of this overwhelming vote for independence in Kyiv and the rest of Ukraine. The question that people normally don't ask, either in Ukraine or outside of Ukraine, why Ukraine became so important and so crucial. And President Yeltsin, at that time president of Russia, provided answer to that question more than once in communications with President Bush. He said that without Ukraine, Russia would be outnumbered and overvoted in basically by Muslim republics in that new structure that would be called Union or Renewed Union after Ukraine's exit. So Russia saw no reason for the continuation with the Soviet Union without Ukraine, the second largest state in terms of economy, in terms of the population, Slavic state, to be part of this imperial project. And once Russia was not interested, the rest of the republics, including Central Asian republics that relied on the Russian economic support, they were not interested in the union as well. And Gorbachev had to resign because there was no state for him to rule anymore.
Ukraine was already moving towards independence in 1991, but the coup seems to be an important turning point that speeded things up and led to the result that it did. Could you comment perhaps how the events of 1991 are relevant today, given the events that have happened in Ukraine in the last 2 years from the annexation of Crimea and the outbreak of war in the Donbas? Is there some sort of a relationship there?
Well, there is a relationship. The disintegration of the Soviet Union happened as a result of a number of factors, but first of all, the position that Ukraine took in after the referendum. So Ukraine's goal was true independence. Russia had a very different view on that. Yeltsin was thinking about confederation, in which there would be a facade of some joint state and Russia would be running that state from behind that facade. So when President Putin, now president of Russia in his third term, addressed the Russian legislature on March 18th, 2014, in his famous or infamous Crimean speech, he said that when the Soviet Union was dissolved, he believed, and others in Russia believed, that the Commonwealth of Independent States, this is just a new form of the joint sovereignty or Russian state, a different form of Russian state, and that's not what happened. So from the very beginning, since 1999, there were different visions in Moscow and in Kyiv of what should come out of Commonwealth of Independent States. The Soviet Union pro forma stopped to exist in December of 91, but it's only then that the real struggle began over what would come out of the Commonwealth of Independent States. And Ukraine wanted it as a form, as a structure that would help a so-called civilized divorce. Russia looked at that as a basically a new imperial project where Russia would still run other republics, not as part of the Union, but with much more stronger and enhanced sovereign, really sovereign prerogatives and capabilities. So the roots of the current crisis should be sought in 1991. And like it was the case in 91, when the future of the Soviet Union for Russia was not any more desirable without Ukraine. Now, without Ukraine, the reintegration project, the project of the economic, political, military reintegration of the post-Soviet space by Russia is incomplete without Ukraine. Again, the reasons are the same. The second largest biggest economy and second largest biggest group in terms of population, Slavic, culturally close to Russians. So Russian thinking in Moscow from that point of view didn't change much since the fall of 91.
You mentioned that Ukraine and Russia had very different visions of their future in 1991. Ukraine is about to celebrate its 25th anniversary. You have just written a new book about Ukraine as the gates of Europe. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what that book is?
Well, it's in many ways, it's a story that covers 2.5 millennia of East European history, but it's also, in terms of its last chapters, it's a continuation of the last empire, in a sense that I go into 1990s and then into the current crisis and Russian annexation of the Crimea and conflict in Donbass. Well, Ukrainian independence became the outcome of the alliance of a number of forces. And those forces include National Democrats, largely based in Western Ukraine, who acted more or less like the reformers were acting in Poland or in Baltic states. Then there was the party elite, led by Leonid Kravchuk. There were liberals in big industrial cities, cities like Kharkiv and Kyiv and Dnipropetrovsk. And then there was the workers' movement, largely based in Donbass. So there were four main players that came together to form independent Ukraine. And what that meant in the long run was that it was sometimes very difficult to make decisions, but also that created a political culture that was the political culture of negotiation and compromise. So that became the foundations of the Ukrainian democracy that is certainly much, much stronger in spite of all its problems than what happened, the kind of democracy that evolved in Russia, or absolute collapse of democratic institutions in Belarus. So the roots for that different political culture are in the ways in which Ukraine acquired its independence in 91. Now, unfortunately, many things changed and came to an end in early 2014. Today, Ukraine faces the fact that when the independence that was won at the ballot box and the democracy that came peacefully in the last years of the Soviet regime, all of that has to be defended with arms. And again, it's a new situation. Ukraine is in the situation of war, despite the fact that maybe it's not so noticeable on the streets of Lviv or streets of Kyiv, but it's a real war. It's a real threat still continuing to the sovereignty and integrity of Ukrainian territory. And violence became, unfortunately, also part of the Ukrainian political scene. And again, that's what we see in Ukraine in the last 2 years. So Ukraine really now in a new stage of its struggle for its independence.
Professor Plokhy, thank you very much for putting current affairs in a historical perspective, both 25 years and 2 millennia. And I hope our readers, our listeners, will have a chance to look at your new book, The Gates of Europe. Thank you very much for joining us.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
This week, a new series of photo ads appeared in downtown Kyiv. Portraits of young Ukrainians with three words underneath: UA, born free. The first one I saw is my favorite. A handsome young man with strong but kind eyes, with his arm around the neck of a horse. Next, I saw a woman wearing a Red Cross helmet over her knitted hat and scarf. It looks like a shot from the winter Euromaidan. It's an interesting contrast with the green leaves on the tree next to the poster. There's also a soldier in a relaxed pose but holding an automatic rifle, and a smiling young woman in a contemporary embroidered chic outfit dancing in a field of wheat. Again, an interesting contrast to the urban landscape where the ad is placed, one of the central streets in Kyiv's capital where cars are rushing past. With all the reports about continued shelling and fears of war escalating in the Donbas, I thought I'd play you a song this week by a Crimean Tatar band, Seyran 762, called Panika Yok. It means don't panic.
Сен қырымлысың ма? Мен де қырымлы кершек, сіз қырымлысыз ма? Асыл жевап екенсіз зәхірімлі олсаңыз Бізлер бір ерден қара деніз Ялы бойу тарафы бера-бер Кен ұзын чой тарафы бера-бер Қаялар юксек дақлар тарафы бера-бер Бүгін сіздер үшін азырланды хабер Бір батан, батан, бір, бір қырым, бір сана Иджат бір микрофон қардашым Сатырлар қафиелер Дұйғылар іле әлетлер язылма Әндейсе діңле Қырымдан рэп хип-хоп Кенеде ялғыра Қырымдан рэп хип-хоп Седа сынында Рэп саада Илериде шоқ ишим бар Рэп саага шоқтан Ачылды қапылар Бір адым екі адым Йолымы таптым Гэнгста дегіл Романтик дегіл Эрдайым Олдскул Рэп олсун Ветім тым Нарменида бегенем Бұна делер қырым Паника йоқ Эршей азыр Азырладым Эр вақыт кіпі сіздер ішін Жаны яйын Паника йоқ Эршей азыр Азырладым Кенеде рэпи жадым Сенің үшін халқым Кенеде рэпи жадым Сенің үшін халқым Қырымдан рэп хип-хоп Сенің үшін
The Mooting Cave is full of anticipation. New benches are being installed on the main street Khrushchatka. Mariinsky Park, which is next to Parliament, looks almost ready for a celebration. The elegant Tsarist era building has been behind scaffolding for years, but over the past few weeks, the fences have started coming down and revealing a facelift, and the gardens have been replanted. Ukraine's planning to celebrate its 25th birthday next week, despite the daily news of Russia ramping up war against it, and internal political squabbles about who is honest and who's not. We'll be following these and other stories. Tune in next week for a new episode of Ukraine Calling. I'm Marta Dechok in Kyiv. Let me know what you think. Our email address is ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. Thanks for listening.